This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, Tracy, good to see you.
Good to be here.
You know, I know that you having children, you realize that injuries are part of life. I know you've been to the emergency room a time or two.
Already, yes.
And you know, most organs that you injure, including the bones, which of course are the most important
yes.
part of the human body,
mm-hmm.
they actually heal fairly quickly and without consequence. But there is one injury that's always of concern to kids and adults alike, and particularly parents, and that is an injury to the brain. And those injuries are not all that uncommon. In fact, I went to the internet to figure out just how many people had a brain injury, serious brain injury every year. And I found out on the CDC site, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, that there are somewhere between 3 and 3.5 million sports and recreational related concussions every year in the United States. And in fact, in the last decade, here's what's interesting. The number of children and adolescents, kids, who mm-hmm. end up in the emergency room for brain injuries has increased some 60%. Concussion is an injury that we've known about and was identified decades ago. We've learned a lot about concussions. We've learned a lot about how to treat concussions, but there are still a lot of things that we don't know. And part of it is because no two concussions are exactly alike. We know more than we used to. And fortunately, our guests know more than you and I do.
That's very good. That's why we have them here. Today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll meet two brain injury experts, rehabilitation specialist Dr. Alan Brown and neurosurgeon Dr. Michael Link. We'll find out what really happens when you have a concussion. We'll talk about the latest treatments. We'll talk about some complications that might occur. And if you've had a concussion, when is it safe to return to play?
Well, there's a controversial issue. We'll get an opinion from our real experts from the Mayo Clinic.
Plus, myths about concussion that every parent needs to know. But first...
Well, in the aftermath, Tracy, of the death, which everybody heard about, the death of actor Philip Seymour Hoffman due to a heroin overdose. Some experts say and have come out and said that heroin is now the heroin problem and the use of heroin is an epidemic, not just in Minnesota, not just in New York, but everywhere in the country. So joining us by telephone is Mayo psychiatrist and drug addiction expert, Dr. Daniel Hall-Flavin. Dr. Hall-Flavin, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, good morning.
So the CDC, is it true, says that the overdose and the use of heroin has become an epidemic in the U.S.?
Yes, it has, and it's been throughout the country. In New York City, within the last 2 years, there's been an 80% rise in heroin-related deaths from heroin overdose. And closer to home in Minneapolis, the statistics are actually more sobering.
Mm-hmm.
From 2011 to 2012, there was an 85% increase in heroin-related deaths in Hennepin County. And then if we go from 2012 to 2013, this number increased by another 50% to 54 deaths. One thing about this is that heroin seems to be cheaper and of higher grade in Minneapolis than it is in many larger cities in the country.
So is heroin getting more stronger, or are more people using it? Is it both?
Well, it could be both. We do know that the number of people using heroin has doubled in the last 7 years. The number of ER visits, including those in the Twin Cities, from heroin-related causes has doubled. There are approximately 2.4 million people in the United States who have acknowledged using heroin, and nearly 700,000 recent users. So that certainly has ticked up.
Well, so this must be because heroin has become cheaper.
Well, it's Could be a variety of reasons. That certainly is one. Historically, you know, the use of heroin has ebbed and flowed in response to other drugs coming into vogue, social stressors, and other factors. But one thing we know that's happened recently, and when I say recently, I mean in the last 10 years, is that there's been a dramatic rise in the use of prescription drugs, which really hasn't been a factor in the past. If we look in the last 15 years, the number of prescriptions that have been written for opioid painkillers has risen by a factor of 4. And so this has been we may not know understand the entire picture, but this is what we feel is an important factor.
Well, so is that like oxycodone, OxyContin? That's what those are?
Yes.
Why? Why are physicians handing out so many more prescriptions for narcotic drugs than they used to?
Well, I think certainly in the 1990s, there was this perception that pain was being undertreated. And while this was most likely true to some extent, the pendulum has swung quite dramatically in the opposite direction. And so what we see is that while illicit drugs tend to follow major transportation routes like interstate highways, and we see them in the major cities, what we're seeing now is opioid use affecting younger people, often in the middle class, and it's throughout the country. It can be in rural areas that are far away from any kind of major roadway.
Where does heroin come from? How does it get to Minnesota?
Well, most of the Minnesota, it's thought that most of the Minnesota heroin is coming from Mexico up the what we would call the I-35 corridor. There has been a number of, if we look at another corridor, the I-95 corridor, there have been two or three states in which there have been a number of deaths recently due to heroin that's been laced with fentanyl. Now, fentanyl is a very potent opiate that's used in surgery. And when it's added to heroin, can make it actually cheaper, but it also makes it much more dangerous.
So what's happening is that people are becoming addicted to their prescription painkillers. They can't get their hands on that anymore because we're getting smarter at regulating or locking those down. And then they turn to heroin? Is that what's happening?
Well, it seems to be one of the avenues behind the current epidemic. If you look at the street value, if we look at economics alone and the street value of, let's say, an 80 milligram tablet of OxyContin, that might go for $40 or more on the street. That becomes a very expensive habit. when you compare this to the same high that can be obtained from a dime bag of heroin, and a dime bag is usually $10, that can be gotten on the street. So we're seeing more people moving from prescription painkillers to heroin.
And what can we do to combat the problem? What should we be doing?
Well, there are several things. First, I think be aware that substance problems or addiction to any substance is an equal opportunity problem. It doesn't discriminate by class, and certainly the tragic death of Mr. Hoffman underscores that. It's also important to understand that most people who use opiates or narcotics legitimately for pain don't become addicted to them. So radically limiting the legitimate use of opiates is not a good response. It's important really to speak up when someone really derisively speaks of an addictive person, you know, for example, using the term junkie. Mm-hmm. You know, addicts are vulnerable. They're not viperous people. It's important to tell them that this is a brain disease and treatment is available. People like Mr. Hoffman and thousands more like him really don't need to die from heroin dependence. And finally, what I would say is that, you know, to tell your legislators that we need more treatment opportunities available for these individuals and more creative thinking, like public health officials have done in Chicago, Milwaukee, and New York. There they've handed out naloxone kits at homeless shelters and other venues. Naloxone reverses the effect of heroin, and in New York City alone, it's been estimated, actually there was a piece that came out in the New York Times yesterday that noted that this action alone may have saved over 500 lives in New York City thus far.
Hmm. You know, there must be a lot of physicians out there or some physicians out there who it's pretty easy to get a prescription for narcotics from. Is that right?
That is correct, yes.
Yeah, and so we probably ought to take a look at that, don't you think?
Absolutely, and I think certainly the various licensing boards and state regulatory agencies are looking at that. There is also a prescription monitoring program, for example, in the state of Minnesota and other states, in which if you are a physician prescribing medications, you can actually, if you have some concerns about the amount of medication a patient may be getting, perhaps not only from you but from someone else, you can actually check that online through these prescription databases.
All right. Dr. Daniel Hall-Flavin, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate the information.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Time for a short break. Coming up, we'll talk with brain injury experts Dr. Alan Brown and Dr. Michael Link, plus myth or matter of fact. It is unusual to fully recover from a traumatic brain injury. Is that a myth or a fact?
We'll find out coming up. And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions at 507-282-1234. You can go to our radio website at radio.mayoclinic.org, or you can tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae, and today's guest, rehabilitation specialist Dr. Alan Brown and neurosurgeon Dr. Michael Link. Dr. Link, Dr. Brown, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
I
think it's fair to say that there's probably not too many minor injuries to the brain, right? I mean, the consequences can be devastating. Shaking your head, yes, so let's go with you, Dr. Brown.
Yeah, they sure can. Every injury to the brain needs to be taken very seriously. There's no doubt about that. Of course, there's a spectrum of injury severity. And it's more likely for symptoms to last if it's more severe. Most mild injuries, though, the symptoms related to those injuries resolve in most people.
Yeah, it is a common enough problem that there is, in fact, a National Brain Injury Month, and that's in March, and so we're way ahead of the game.
Yeah, way ahead of the game. Well, I think we decided to do this program after, I don't even remember when it was, yet another professional athlete had come forward with some, maybe it was when Favre said, you know, I think I've had some issues with concussions over the years. What does it do? We'll speak specifically about some of those multiple concussion type problems. What does that ultimately end up doing to your brain?
Well, we don't really know for sure. There's been many studies that looked at what is the cumulative effect of repeated brain injury. And certainly some of the studies have suggested that it does result in long-term cognitive issues. There was actually a very large study that came out of Minnesota that had actually 50 years of follow-up on high school football players that didn't show any increased risk of dementia, Parkinson's disease, some of these other things. But I think we're all very cautious about repeated head injury and what the long-term consequences can be.
Is there a difference when a teen athlete has a brain injury versus when an adult, you know, slips and falls or is in a minor car accident? Is there a difference?
Yeah, I think there definitely is. So the more immature the brain, the younger the brain, the greater the susceptibility to brain injury and the long-term effects.
So you certainly want to protect children, and that is of some concern because of all the kids that are playing hockey and football and the other sports, and soccer?
Right. Yeah, in fact, both men's and women's soccer is one of the high-risk sports for concussion, actually.
It is unusual to fully recover from a traumatic brain injury. Myth or matter of fact, Dr. Brown?
The most common severity of brain injury is a mild injury, and it's most common for those symptoms to resolve completely. Now, having said that, as Mike said, the cumulative effect of many injuries needs to be really taken seriously.
So when we talk about concussion, and that's 75% of brain injuries are concussions, right? What do you really mean when you say someone has had a concussion? What is it really?
Well, the technical definition is just a post-traumatic alteration of brain function, and it gets a little bit, I think, technical talking about what happens, you know, at the cellular level or so on. But for instance, it does not mean that the person has to lose consciousness to suffer a concussion. It can just be even a very transient alteration in brain function. So when somebody is confused, has a post-injury headache, all those things are signs of concussion.
So you don't have to lose consciousness to have had a concussion?
Definitely not. In fact, most concussions occur when there is not loss of consciousness.
But if you have, if the athlete has or the person has lost consciousness, how does that change how you treat them?
It certainly is a sign of a more significant brain injury if there's actually been loss of consciousness, even a short loss of consciousness. So that indicates a more serious injury and more serious observation afterwards to make sure that there's good recovery.
And you don't have to hit your head to have a concussion. Just some kind of external mechanical force that can force your brain to move about in the skull can also affect brain function.
Is it a side impact? I know three people who have been hit from the side in a car just in town, a minor car accidents, but they are hit from the side and all three of them have had some brain injury or some sort of concussion because of it.
Yeah, it really doesn't matter where on the head the blow would occur.
Okay.
And as Alan mentioned, even just what we call angular force can do it. So you don't even have to hit your head if you're in a car accident and the car stops suddenly and your head whips forward, that can be enough to cause a concussion.
Your brain is going fast enough in your skull that's what makes the difference.
That's right. You know, the brain floats in fluid inside the skull, which is very hard, and so the head stops, but the brain sloshes forward, you might say, and can sustain injury.
And the brain's kind of soft.
It is, yeah.
So if you don't have to have, as part of the criteria for a concussion, if you don't have to have lost consciousness, how do you make the diagnosis?
Yeah, it's kind of tricky business, it turns out, and it's a little bit of a moving target. But whenever a person complains of headache, being confused, one of the best indicators, if you just think about all, kids playing sports today, if you're suspicious, a great way to test is to test their balance function. Just get them on the sideline and see how they do with, standing upright with their eyes closed, standing with one foot in front of their other with their eyes closed.
Just as if you were checking for inebriation.
Basically.
Give them the drug test.
That's a pretty good analogy, yeah.
And that and what about confusion? I mean, what are the questions that you would ask an athlete that might help you know whether or not they'd had a concussion?
Well, one of the key things to ask a football player, for instance, is what was the last play? But then just some basic orientation things: what day is it? What time is it? What's the month? What's the year? One of the common things that they actually ask professional athletes is, where'd you park your car today? And, if they can't answer those things very quick, that's pretty good indication something's wrong.
I remember a quote from Aaron Rodgers, who said he just got up after a concussion, just got him, said, "I'm fine." And he said, and of course you're going to say that because you don't know. And so I thought that was an interesting way to put it, that it's, you know, it's, as Dr. Shives just said, if you ask a drunk person, "Are you too drunk to drive?" "Nope, I'm fine." Because they can't tell because they have that injury.
And not to mention, too, both, I think, at all levels of athletics, athletes want to play. So one of the reasons why I think the incidence of concussion has gone up has just been our awareness of it. And I think also many athletes' awareness of it, that this is a serious thing, and that's obviously really good news that people are becoming more mindful.
I think last week Dr. Shives said we all rang our bell. That's what when we were kids, we all got our bell rung. Dr. Brown, is it fair to say that what we used to say was you have to wake somebody up with a concussion every 20 minutes? Is that a myth or is that a fact, Dr. Brown?
Well, it certainly is important for people to be observed. You can't really sort of make a general statement that everyone needs to be woken up, because that can affect, normal sleep patterns and quality of life and things like that. And it really sort of depends on how severe the injury is. But certainly a period of observation is important.
What have we learned about treating people with concussion? It used to be a long time ago, you got your bell rung, you go back in and play, or when you feel better, you play, or when your headaches go away. But now it seems like you talk more about the brain having complete rest as part of the treatment, right?
Generally speaking, there should be relative rest in all phases of life. You know, I mean, if it depends on your circumstances, if you're working or if you're in this example, if you're an athlete, it's important that you not play sports, of course, and also in academic life, in school, and things like that. You really need to take a break and really not stress your brain in any way that you can imagine. And then gradually, as your symptoms resolve, then it's a matter of a stepwise process back to your normal activities, including sport-related activities.
How was it different for the soldiers who are returning from the Middle East that are suffering from traumatic brain injuries? Is there a psychological component that goes along with theirs, or is their recovery different from an athlete's recovery?
I think it's hard to say. I think no question that the circumstances in which a soldier would sustain a traumatic brain injury are much different than anybody in civilian life. So
yeah, it's the concussion, those IEDs go off. So
I think there's certainly a component of post-traumatic stress disorder, which would have some of the similar symptoms of a post-concussive symptom. So it's almost kind of a double whammy in a sense.
What about the use of painkillers, pain medications after a concussion in an athlete? Appropriate or not?
Certainly if they have a headache, then pain medicine is absolutely appropriate. We like to have people avoid aspirin and aspirin-related compounds just because of the very small risk of intracranial bleeding with those. So we prefer acetaminophen, which is, Tylenol. Occasionally, people do have enough pain that we even do prescribe opioids occasionally. But we try and also want to avoid sedating medication.
All right. So if you have a concussion, complete rest of the brain is important.
It is.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guests are brain injury experts Dr. Alan Brown and Dr. Michael Link. Coming up, health and medical news from Vivian Williams, and then we'll take your phone calls at 507-282-1234, comments from and questions from our website at radio.mayoclinic.org.
And don't forget your tweets, #, Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our immune systems work hard. Every day they battle to protect us from infections. But research shows that our immune response may make us vulnerable to the very same bacteria it's trying to protect us against. A study published in the journal Immunity reveals a certain protein in our immune system enhances the growth of some bacteria, like Salmonella, which causes food poisoning. They say it seems a protective response may help the growth of something like Salmonella by suppressing growth of its competitors. Researchers from the University of California, Irvine say their findings have important implications for the development of treatment strategies. And in other news, here's some encouraging information in the fight against brain cancer. A clinical trial co-led by researchers at Mayo Clinic Cancer Center and Wake Forest School of Medicine found that adding chemotherapy following radiation treatment improves survival for adults with low-grade gliomas by about 5.5 years. Now, gliomas are tumors that begin in the brain or a spinal cord, and they are the most common form of primary brain tumor. Here's Mayo Clinic Dr. Jan Buckner.
Low-grade gliomas is a kind of slower-growing tumor that arises in the brain. And there are different varieties, but usually it occurs in men more than women, in young people in their 20s, 30s, 40s. And most of the time, the first sign that there's anything wrong is that the person has a seizure. I think the next stage is, okay, can we identify patients that are most likely to benefit from treatment? So we're in the process of analyzing the tumor tissue from the patient so that we will be able to say who really should be treated.
And here's news about vitamin D and multiple sclerosis. A study led by the Harvard School of Public Health shows for patients in the early stages of MS, low levels of vitamin D
vitamin D were found to predict how severe the disease would be and how quickly it would likely progress. These findings suggest that patients in the early stages of MS could stave off symptoms by increasing their vitamin D intake. Now, research says since low vitamin D levels are pretty common and oral supplements can safely raise them, this information could lead to better outcomes for many patients. Now, MS is a central nervous system disease that causes problems with things like muscle control, vision, balance, and thinking. The researchers say getting proper vitamin D levels for these patients should become standard of care. And this was published in the journal JAMA Neurology. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Information you want from specialists who know. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on air, online, and on iHeartRadio. Now, let me get this straight.
You can listen 24 hours a day.
All right. Now, on iHeartRadio.
Yes.
But you can't listen live on iHeartRadio. You can listen to previous programs on iHeartRadio.
And in minutes.
All right.
Or Mayo Clinic Radio minutes.
And if you want to listen live, you go to KROCAM.com.
That's
and
right.
You can listen live that way.
That's our flagship station.
All right.
Station,
I think
yes.
I got it straight.
Very good.
Time for you to join our conversation. You can contact us. Telephone number 507-282-1234. We welcome your phone calls. Or go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Or you can tweet us. It's not number sign, it's hashtag
there
now.
You go.
Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guests, both brain injury experts, Dr. Alan Brown, Dr. Michael Lincoln. You know, before we start to talk about returning to play and when you can do that and the long-term consequences of head injuries, particularly concussions, I want to knock off some of these myth or matter of facts. And
okay.
I like this one. Male athletes sustain more concussions than female ones. Myth or matter of fact?
Well, it's actually a fact in that there are more male athletes per year that get concussions, but it turns out that female athletes are more susceptible to concussions.
Hmm. Interesting, huh? Now, how do you, there's no explanation for that, is there?
Yeah, well, probably we think that one of the...
Brains are softer?
Brains are bigger.
Bigger, that's it.
Yeah. So just so long as the audience
that's what I
knows
meant to
that
say.
It was Tom Shives that made
right.
that comment. It probably has something to do with neck muscle strength, actually. Mm. And so the female athletes can't absorb the blow, you might say, as well to the head because their necks aren't as strong, so there's more acceleration, deacceleration.
So I have seen advertisements for particular devices on the internet that can strengthen your neck muscles. You're suggesting that those might be a good idea?
Well, probably not. It turns out that the best idea is to not get hit in the head.
Sure.
And of course, we can't control that. But probably any benefit you're going to obtain from trying to buy a device to strengthen your neck muscles probably isn't going to make much difference.
All right. Now, before we go to Stella, I got another quick one. An athlete who has had one concussion is more likely to have another than an athlete who hasn't been concussed. Myth or matter of fact? Dr. Brown?
Technically, that is true. Having a history of traumatic brain injury increases your risk for future injury.
All right. If you've had one, you're more likely to have another one.
Well, let's talk with Stella in Davenport, Iowa, who has had 9 concussions.
Oh,
Stella, good morning and welcome to the program. What's your question?
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a current Mayo patient with chronic migraines, kind of severe chronic migraine. And I wondered if my multiple concussions, as a person who played a polo and I'd had 9 concussions, whether that made it worse for the cumulative or what's the relationship between chronic migraine and brain injury?
All right. Good question, Stella.
That is a very good question. And in fact, that's actually been studied in patients who have a history of migraine. Have been shown to have a higher susceptibility to getting concussion and to have a longer post-concussion recovery.
Hmm.
So I think, Stella, there is a connection.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling in.
Yep. All the way from deepest, darkest Iowa. That's you, God's country.
I knew
down
that
there.
You had a soft spot in your heart for
well,
her.
Well, so does Dr. Link.
Well, Dr. Brown.
By Hawkeye.
Dr. Brown, can you... In the week, you had given an example about how a brain injury can be likened to a sprained ankle. Can you explain that? How did that go? Was that Dr. Link or Dr. Brown that did that? I don't know which one of you said
it was
that.
Dr. Link.
All right, go ahead, Dr. Link.
Well, we used to think an athlete or a person has a concussion, and then if they more or less felt okay, they could get right back into activity. But of course, we know when somebody sprains an ankle that we don't just say, okay, if you sprained your ankle playing basketball, don't play basketball, but you can do everything else. You can run and walk around. We, of course, say, you know, don't put any weight on it and keep it braced. And basically, the analogy is we need to do about the same thing with the brain. As Alan said, it has to be very individualized per individual. But if somebody has a concussion, not only shouldn't they go back to an activity where they could sustain a second head injury in short order, but they have to be symptom-free and they have to rest the brain. And that may be cutting back on a schoolwork or even class attendance.
What about those tiny little screens in their hands?
Yeah, that can also be trouble. Video games, those kinds of things. And most activity is okay as long as it keeps them symptom-free. We don't need to follow the dark room analogy. But
okay.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones, 507-282-1234. Gina is a teacher and has a question. Good morning, Gina.
Good morning. I'm just curious. I teach lower elementary grade students, and they are bonking into each other and getting their heads bonked at recess. They can walk in the hall and run into each other. And typically, you know, there are no symptoms afterwards. If they're complaining, we give them an ice pack, have them sit, I watch them. You know, we alert parents, but within the school, what's your suggestion after we know a child has hit his or her head?
Yep,
should they be doing that balance test on them, or what should they do?
Well, they don't always even have good balance.
That's true.
It's a little hard to tell sometimes.
That's right.
Well, Gina, of course, that's a great question. The you know, we talked a little bit about, you know, you don't have to hit your head to have a head injury, but it's also true that every time you hit your head, that doesn't mean you've had a concussion.
Right.
And so, you know, it's important that you're doing just what you're doing. Get, you know, treat their symptoms. If they have, you know, a bonk in the head and they need some ice, that's great. Observing their behavior is really important. So I think you're doing the right thing. I don't think we should assume that everyone that has a bonk like that on the playground or in school, you know, has a concussion and needs to be, you know, seek medical attention right then.
So what you're doing is right.
Yep.
Good. Good. Well, that's good to know, because you hate to keep them out of recess when they want to play, but you want to balance out their long-term health. And so that's good to know.
Yeah. Hey. I think common sense, I think you're doing precisely the right thing for these kids.
Okay, thank you very much.
Hey, Gina, thanks for the call, and thanks for all you do.
Oh,
we truly appreciate the teachers in the world.
Right.
Thanks so much. All right, this is for all the parents in America.
Okay.
Everyone who hits their head should have a CT or MRI scan. Myth or matter of fact? Dr. Link.
I'd say myth for certain.
Does it show up on a CT or an MRI?
Almost never. So even with an MRI scan, which is very sensitive imaging of the brain, there's no real imaging correlate for a concussion. So in fact, now we know, certainly for children, even young adults, certainly we want to limit radiation exposure, even that they get from a routine CAT scan. So unless there's a focal neurologic finding.
Neurologic finding?
So something like a weakness or numbness in one part of the body, or some pupils of the eyes being asymmetric, or trouble maintaining their level of consciousness where they're constantly falling asleep, then they don't need a CAT scan or MRI scan.
All right. And your preference, I would presume, in most instances would be an MRI because it doesn't involve any radiation. The CT scan requires a fair amount of radiation. So you want to avoid that and do an MRI if there is an indication to do any scan?
So if it's an acute injury and we're worried that there is a problem going on, even though there's a small amount of radiation involved, we still prefer a CAT scan.
Really?
Because what we're looking for is an acute hemorrhage, bleeding inside the brain that we need to do something about on an urgent basis. In follow-up, if somebody comes back and has ongoing symptoms that won't resolve and we're worried about something going on in the brain, then we would do an MRI scan.
So you're saying that you can see the blood easier on the CT versus the MRI?
Yes.
And if there is blood there, why is it an emergency and what do you have to do?
Well, the most urgent emergency, you might say, is when there's bleeding that occurs over the surface of the brain or even outside the covering of the brain. That's called either a subdural hematoma if it's below the covering of the brain or an epidural hematoma if it's over the covering of the brain.
And this dura is like the saran wrap on top of the brain that surrounds the brain.
It's basically the sac that the brain sits in, yeah, okay, and the spinal fluid is underneath it.
And you can have a bleed above that or below that.
Right.
Okay.
And you may recall a couple years ago, there was an actress who fell skiing and then died of an epidural hematoma a few hours later. Mm-hmm. And so that's certainly the most worrisome type of injury that we think about as neurosurgeons. That's where the patient has that lucid interval where they're okay after a head injury and very well may tell you they're okay and then suddenly deteriorate. And those are the people who need to go right to the operating room.
So they fall when they're skiing or they slip on the ice or something and they're jump right up. No loss of consciousness, feel fine, but then things start to change over the coming hours.
Exactly.
Okay. Right, because more blood accumulates there. There's a vein or an artery or something that's still bleeding. And ultimately you get enough blood there. And then how do they die? Well, if you don't evacuate the blood, what happens?
So what happens is the blood accumulates and starts to push the brain. Right. And the brain can accommodate for that up to a point, and then it loses its ability to accommodate. And then the parts of the brain push on the deep parts of the brain stem that keep us awake and alive and breathing. And then that ultimately will prove fatal if we don't get the blood clot out and get the pressure off.
What's the important thing that either one of you would like the people who are volunteer coaches for little kids, third graders, all the way up to high school kids and, you know, some organized sports, many of them volunteer, most of them no training, but what is the important thing that they need to know to help keep their players safe? Dr. Brown?
They need to have the knowledge to recognize a concussion, and they need to take those individuals out of, those kids out of play when they recognize it, and they need to know what to do thereafter, keep them out of play until they're asymptomatic. And it's mostly to have knowledge about this and to act when they see a concussion occur.
If the kid can get up and run off of the field, no matter what sport it is, that doesn't mean that they're okay. Fair to say?
Right. They need to be evaluated to assure that that's true. Yeah.
Is there a standard list of things that most trainers should do in terms of testing? Are there guidelines out there?
Yes, there are specific guidelines for a clinical evaluation on the sideline, and that's part of the education process that is now written in statute in many states in law that coaches need to understand, and those evaluations need to occur before people can go back to play.
And is there anything on the horizon? Is there any research being done or anything that we can look forward to finding out?
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things that's going to happen is now that there's been great interest in the long-term effects of concussion, I think we're going to learn a lot more. We're going to see a lot more what we call epidemiologic studies, where they survey large groups of the population who have sustained even minor concussion and follow them over time so we can find out what's going to be the long-term consequence of some of these traumatic brain injuries.
All right, we need to talk about return to play. When is it okay for an athlete, a young athlete, to go back on the field, return to athletic participation? And one of the interesting things that you have done in recent years, your entire group who cares for these kids, is do some pre-injury testing. And what's involved there?
So there's a variety of instruments or tools, you might say, that people have done at all levels, high school up through professional athletics. Some of them are actual what we call psychometric testing, where they are paper and pencil kind of tests that people take, could take up to 4 hours to take all the tests that examine the various functions of the brain. So there's a good baseline. So if an athlete gets injured, then you can go back and retake the test and find out where they are. There's also a much easier tests that are on the computer that, for instance, the whole team can take at once, mm-hmm. and you can kind of get it out of the way, and then you have a baseline. One of the problems is we don't really know what's a meaningful difference in the score as the season goes on.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe an athlete would be suspected of having a concussion, retake the test, and does it matter if he's 3 points off or 5 points off? We don't really know that yet, and that's what we're working to try and sort out.
Yeah, but you'd like to see them back at baseline before
yes.
you allow them to go back and play based on their psychometric testing that they had before the season ever started.
Yeah, we think that's a pretty good benchmark to help guide when to return to play. And the one thing that I'll reiterate or say to Tracy's last question is the important thing is that there is no return to play on the same day that you think mm-hmm. an athlete has had a concussion. So that's, I think, agreed upon universally. If the athlete's had a concussion, no return to play that day.
And I think it's important to point out also that this the pre-participation psychometric testing and things like that, if someone has a concussion, that's only one piece of clinical information to consider when you're making decisions about returning to play.
And once they get back to baseline, is it okay to go full bore right away, or is there some progression of return to play?
Sure. So after there are no symptoms at rest or just doing normal activities, then there's some light physical activity if for a period of time. If there are no symptoms associated with that, then it's then progression into sports-specific, light sports-specific activity. And then if that doesn't have any symptoms associated with it, then back to sort of full contact practice. And then if no symptoms related to that, then they're okay to go.
Are you both pretty well convinced that there is a relationship between concussion or multiple concussions during a career and the ultimate development of dementia or Alzheimer's?
I would say that I'm not completely convinced. I don't think we just know enough yet, but there's really strong suggestion of that. And I think the best, group to look at that in, of course, is boxers, where the goal of that contest is to give your opponent a concussion. and I mean, we've seen that time and time again. You know, you don't have to see many interviews of retired boxers
right.
to be convinced there must be a connection there.
All right. Yes, Dr.
Well,
Brown?
So there seems to be a link between multiple concussions and the potential or risk for developing dementia or degenerative neurologic impairment in some people. But we have not yet come to the point where we can predict with any certainty for an individual.
All right, so we would all agree that concussion is a serious injury. The baseline testing is important, particularly for middle school and high school athletes. And if you do have a concussion, complete rest of the brain is important. And before you go back to the play, you need to get back to baseline and do that progressively when you go back, right? Dr. Link, Dr. Brown, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Well, Tracy, February is American Heart Month, and we're still in February. So next week on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk with two experts on heart disease, both women, Dr. Rekha Mankad, who we've met before, and Dr. Sharon Mulvaugh, who has also been on the program. They're both great cardiologists.
And so excited to help spread the word, because so many women are much more afraid of cancer, and actually heart disease is a bigger risk to their health.
Far and away the mm-hmm. biggest risk to women's health as well as men's. And you know, this year marks the 50th anniversary of American Heart Month. So
I didn't know that.
That's exciting, and we're going to celebrate it next next
you better wear red
week and tell you all about what you can do to prevent heart disease. We'll tell you who's at risk, who needs to be concerned about heart disease, and what you can do to prevent it. We'll tell you 7 things you can and should do to prevent heart disease and stroke. We call it Life's Simple 7. You
well,
won't want to miss it.
The 5-10-8, 5 fruits and vegetables, 10 minutes more of exercise, and 8 hours of sleep, Tom.
Oh, all of that. Plus, that's Life's Complex 7.
That's right.
All right, next week on Mayo Clinic Radio.
You can visit us at mayoclinic.org, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers from Mayo Clinic will share their expertise to empower you to better manage your health. And go to that same address to check out our website for more episodes of this program.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer is Ron Petrovich, our associate producer and phone screener Audrey Castletine, our technical director KD, Kim David. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio and Dr. Michael Link and Dr. Alan Brown, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Thanks for being with us.
During this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.